The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot. CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls. Tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts, and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part one of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They?, a series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part one focuses on redlining, racial covenants, and other institutional policies which created and continue to enforce segregation. We focus on Chicago, but these issues are national and probably happening somewhere not too far from where you're listening. If you're not familiar with Chicago neighborhoods, the context should make things clear. This program is dedicated to Lorraine Hansberry, the award-winning Black lesbian author of A Raisin in the Sun, and her father, Carl Augustus Hansberry, who fought and won the fight against race covenants in Chicago. You'll hear an excerpt from the film version of A Raisin in the Sun in the middle of the program. At the end of the program, you'll hear poet, playwright, and essayist June Jordan reading her essay Requiem for the Champ, a poetic illustration of the ways segregation impacts people's lives, recorded in Berkeley, California in 1992.
My name is Gian Foreman. I am the president and CEO of the Emerald South Economic Development Collaborative. Emerald South was created as a result of some really strong community leaders, the University of Chicago, the City of Chicago, and the Obama Foundation coming together. And we wanted to make sure that there's economic development that's felt in the community, not just only the Obama Center, right? How would we feel in the community? How would we get the economic benefit from this, right? And so why would this be a positive thing for the community? And so Emerald South was created to basically kind of be this organization that was a kind of a listening ear and could kind of be a liaison between the Obama Foundation, the city, the university, and these incredible community organizations that already exist. And so, so our first program that we have is a program called Terra Firma. So I saw this study that was done in Philadelphia where they basically improved vacant lots. They kept the grass cut. They put up fencing. They employed local people in the community to do so. And they found that 27% reduction in homicides, a 69% increase in people's mental health. About 300 people were employed and about 30 companies, entrepreneurs, local entrepreneurs to hire to do so. So we basically just mimic that. And so to date, we've worked on about 67 acres of vacant land. And so, you know, thinking about the vacant land, not as a liability, but as an asset. You know, you have a big opportunity like the Obama Foundation is bringing attention to these communities where that attention never was. And so will there be people moving in that look different from us, that have higher incomes, different education levels? Yes, there will. But like I just said, there's 260 acres of vacant land. So I think about it that there's enough room for everyone. I think it's important that as a community, the existing residents come together and say, okay, it's 200, that's Disneyland. How do we design Disneyland so it works for us? Right. There is going to be a place where you can buy a $20 hamburger, but there should still be a place to buy a $5 hamburger. Right. My grandmother came to Chicago and they couldn't even live in some of these communities. Right. They couldn't live in South Shore, couldn't live in Hyde Park or Woodlawn. And so, you know, but when they did, there was white flight. There was redlining. So, you know, redlining was this policy that was created where literally you can see on maps where there were lines drawn and there were no mortgages that were given, right? Essentially, these were the places where Black people lived. And so it caused values to really crash. There was no home ownership, right? You know, people in these communities, they weren't afforded that. And so as a result, there was blight, right? There was a lot of loss of wealth that was created as a result of these policies. And so, you know, along with blight comes a host of other issues, right? Crime and poverty and, you know, this failing schools and all of the things that we suffer from today. And so I think that was a policy. It was done. And, you know, it's public now that this was happened, but there was never anything done to kind of address it. But one time when I was in Holland, I saw a field of tulips and it was just magnificent. It looked magical, looked like it wasn't a real thing. And so I came back and I said, man, I'm going to plant tulips here. And I looked up the cost of tulips and I was like, no, I'm not planting tulips here. And so we planted sunflowers, right? Easy to plant, easy to grow and all of that. Amanda Williams and I, we've been friends for a while. And so it's been really great. Amanda's come out with her family and helped us plant, but I told her the story. You know, I wanted to do tulips. And she's like, oh, you know, man, I love tulips, too. I've been wanting to do something with tulips as well. Then she came and said, hey, I have the funding. I want to do these tulips, right? And tie it into your Terra Firma program. And I was like, man, that's wonderful, right? And I'm thinking it's just going to be a field of tulips. But she took it a step further and said, hey, redefining redlining. These communities were strongly impacted by redlining. So she went out and looked up what was here. The only thing in my lifetime I've ever seen was a vacant lot. I didn't think anything of it. It was barren. It was like going into a desert. But she actually went and looked up the maps to see what buildings actually lived here. Who were some of the people who owned the buildings, who lived in the buildings? And so she actually mapped it out and had students from IIT come and draw the borders of the buildings that actually existed here. And those flowers were planted in the shapes of the buildings that were once there. So there are a lot of stories here, a lot of lives, a lot of wealth that was lost here. So in one step, it's a beautiful thing, right? It says, hey, wow, I could never imagine. It gives you the ability to dream and imagine what's possible. In another sense, right, imagine what it is to be that little kid who wakes up and looks out the window and you see this beautiful flower that looks like Millennium Park outside of your bedroom window. We don't know the kind of impact that that could have on that kid. That kid might be an architect, might be a botanist, might be a community development person, might be an artist. That could motivate that kid to do anything. But also, again, we only hear the negative stories of community. And so now you have people literally from around the world coming to my community. Wow. You have people who lived in the building say, hey, come on, let me show you. There's a yellow one over here. There's a purple one right there. They took pride in this, right? They before may have thrown trash down, then they started picking up trash, right? So then there's also this symbolism to it. This wasn't just us. We could have paid professionals to come out and just, hey, plant the whole thing. But we invited people from the community to come out and plant too, right? So that was wonderful because the professionals, they got to school us a little bit. And people say, oh, you need to put some of this on top of, put bone meal on top. Everybody had their own little trick that they would kind of give us. Hey, the rabbits don't like this, so make sure you put this on top. We were worried about rabbits. We were worried about squirrels, all this kind of stuff. And so now we get it planted. And all winter, Amanda and I were worried, like, is this going to work? There's 100,000 tulip bulbs. Is this actually going to work? We didn't know because this was an experiment. And then a nice spring day, you started to see something, little green thing, poke out from the ground. And I called Amanda, hey. Hey, it's growing, it's working. Every week, it's a little bit more. But it seemed like it was moving in slow motion. And then they were really tall, but it was all green. And this is a true story. I was coming from out of town. I got off the expressway. I'm like, let me just go and see what's happening. And I got out of my car. Now, this is 3.5 acres of vacant lots that's filled with tulip bulbs, four corners. You know, this whole time we've been looking. Get out of the car, and there was one red flower. One. Everything else was green, but it was one red flower. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's a red flower. I called Amanda. Amanda, it's a red flower. It worked. I came back the next day, and 100% of the flowers were red. And then it was just like, boom. I'm a bike rider, so I was told my wife, hey, I'm going out for a bike ride. And so I was like, before I go, I'm just going to ride by and check out the flowers. And I went by, and it was so beautiful. I went home, I changed clothes, I came back out, and I picked up trash in the field every day. Trash blows. And so my wife said to me, you gave up riding your bike to come pick up trash? And I said, it was the most peaceful thing that I think I've ever done. I actually had fun picking up trash all day and talking to the visitors who came by to say, what is this? How did this happen? We had to do a little work on the front end. Import some things, right? Then we had to take the amateurs with the experts and put us together. And everybody kind of gave their tip on what was happening. And then the bulb did what it had to do. And then it takes a lot of worry and a little bit of time. And then one thing happens, one action, and then it all comes together. And it doesn't last forever, but it lasts for a good amount of time, enough for us to appreciate it and take pictures. And that's kind of how community grows, right? And so now some of the people who came out who had one thought about what the South Side was like, they now have a different story. You know, so we're hoping that this is the start of us thinking about how to value our communities, right? How to bring resources to our communities. We don't have to wait for the city or the county, or the state, or the federal government to do something, right? And so that started to happen. And if we want to build community, these are some of the kind of things that we have to do. Now, one day, there'll be a building on one of these lots. Our idea is that we can then pull up those tulip bulbs, and we can put it on another lot. I think that it's not up to us necessarily to say what's next. Yeah, certainly we will continue to think of other things. Last year, we tried cotton. Didn't work, but I'm not going to give up on it, though. I'm going to try it again. I went to school in the South, and, you know, all the guys, my friends, we grew up in Chicago. You know, from slavery, we heard about cotton, but we never saw a cotton field. And the first time I saw a cotton field, you have no choice but to just start crying, right? It's from here. I live in Hyde Park. It was cotton from here to the Sears Tower, as far as the eye could see. And you just say, like, damn, this is what my ancestors had to do. And the thorns on the cotton bush as big as my finger. I made my daughter get out one time and go pick some just so she could just have that kind of experience, right? And I thought about how can we be good stewards of the earth? That's step one. Then step two, what would it look like for us all to own this land communally? What would it mean, right? It would give you a different kind of value. Right. And so I think that the idea is to spark the imagination, to ask other people, what should we do? Prairie plants and flowers certainly are important. The sunflowers, they help to remediate lead from the soil. So do the tulips, but the taller the plant, they help to remediate flooding. Anything you plant, it helps mitigate flooding. So if I ask people in the community, do you care about global warming? Nah, man, I care about a job. And if I ask them, does your basement flood? They say, yeah, of course my basement floods. Everybody's basement floods. Oh, so you do care about global warming, right? So when you plant some things, that also helps. So I think, like I said earlier, I think it gives us the ability to dream and think about what's possible. Nobody could have imagined 100,000 tulips, and we pulled it off. So what else is possible? You know, I think that this was a project that, like I said, we've been thinking about improving the neighborhood to get those kind of results that I talked about. But I think it took the artist to really kind of tell this story in a way that I'm not sure that I ever could have, right? To tie history to the present, to the future. And so I think it's important that as we are thinking about how to improve our communities, as we're thinking about complex problems, it's important that you don't just think that you always have the right answer, to bring this diversity of thought in. Just like somebody said, put some bone meal on the tulip. Somebody else said, put some cinnamon because the squirrels won't eat that. Everybody had their own idea that they were able to bring to it. And that's what I thought that Amanda did in an incredible way. She forced us all to think about this asset in a different kind of way, right? And so I think she brought out the artist in all of us. We got a chance to see how similar we are. The obvious difference, your skin is white, my skin is dark. Oh, that's obvious. But we share some of those things, right? And so when we try to find our commonalities, you know, we end up getting together in a whole completely different kind of way, you know? And it was really just a function of us getting to know each other. Right. So I think that this one of the goals that we hope is that people do think about our community in a different way and see the reason why this is important to invest in places like this, and that our stories are not very dissimilar. We all had some migration, whether or not if it was from Europe to Ellis Island or if it was from Mississippi. We all had some migration.
Travis, you know that money we got in the mail this morning?
Yes, sir.
But what do you think your grandmama done went and done?
I don't know, Grandma.
Well, she went and she bought you a house. You glad about the house? It's gonna be yours when you get to be a man.
Yes, sir. I always did want to live in a house, Grandma.
So you went and did it?
Yes, I did.
Great. A home. Where is it? How big? How much? When are we moving?
The first of the month. It's a nice house. It's got 3 bedrooms. And there's a big one for you and Ruth. Of course, me and Benita still has to share ours, but Travis will have a room of his own. And I figure if the new baby is a boy, we could get one of them double-decker outfits, you know. And it's got a yard with a little patch of dirt in it that I could maybe get to grow me a few flowers. And it's got a great big basement. Of course, I don't want to make it sound fancy, and it is. It's just a plain little old house. But it's built good and solid, and it'll be ours.
Where is it?
Clyburn Park.
Where?
4930 Clyburn Street, Clyburn Park.
Clyburn Park? Mama, they don't call it people living in Clyburn Park.
Well, there's going to be some now.
My name is Natalie Moore. I'm a reporter and editor at WBEZ, which is the Chicago NPR member station. And I'm also the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. I joke that the book is my dissertation for having worked at WBEZ about, you know, close to 10 years at that point. And all the stories that I was covering, you know, housing, economic development, violence, et cetera, the big thing that was, the thing that was not talked about was segregation. And that to me was the connective tissue on all of these issues. And previously, segregation was something that was accepted as a natural occurrence and not something that was man-made, government-sanctioned, privately, you know, private sector jumping in on it too. And so this was my way to build upon the work that academics have done and make it for a general audience, but also using my and my family's story to get that across. And I wanted the academics to read it and say, she has good footnotes, she knows what she's talking about, but you know, it was not meant to be an academic book, but also to, you know, not just my own research, but building upon the existing scholarship. Basically, the federal government drew a map in the 1930s and did it color code it, and Black neighborhoods were deemed red. These were the places that they did not want loans to go to. And this was at, around the time that the federal government said the pathway to building the middle class and to building wealth is through home ownership. So interest rates have gone down. It wasn't just something that the very wealthy could do. But for African-Americans in Chicago and elsewhere around the country, that those reds were just giant red flags, literally and figuratively, to say don't give loans here. In a place like Chicago, you're seeing that in the Black Belt, the place where African-Americans moved to during the Great Migration. And so there's this, I don't know if joke is the right word, but there's all the maps of Chicago pretty much look the same when you're looking at inequity, where violence happens, lack of grocery stores, lack of amenities. You know, it's the South and West sides, the Black neighborhoods show those. And these are the same maps that were with redlining. And, you know, it, even going back before redlining, a place like Chicago, the Great Migration starting after World War II, there was an opportunity for integration. And the various public and private sector players said that we don't want this. And one of the ways that they did that, this predates the redlining, was racially restrictive covenants. So you couldn't rent or sell your home to people who were non-white. And instead of creating Jim Crow districts or saying you can't live in a neighborhood, they attached it to property, which then translated into neighborhoods. The Chicago Housing Authority wasn't doing home ownership. They were like just where public housing was built. And so high rises were built in neighborhoods where white older people did not want them. So you had slum clearance in the Black Belt. You had new housing come up that ended up being a second slum. Sometimes people say integration killed the Black community because they may feel like middle class Black people left certain neighborhoods or that all these Black businesses went away. And to be sure, Black segregated neighborhoods had agency. They had people who cared about them. None of this is ever about Black neighbors needing white neighbors to be better or Black school children needing to sit next to white children for them to be better. All of this is related to proximity to power and resources and just how our country is set up. So I think that that's like the baseline that's there. But a lot of these neighborhoods in the Black, like the Black Belt, for example, there weren't as many Black-owned businesses as maybe people think that there were. Segregation also meant that you might die because a hospital wouldn't take you, or you're going to an overcrowded school. And so I understand the romanticization because it's really Black people saying, we're good people. We can create good communities. We don't need white people. And that's not really what I'm arguing or the point of arguing against segregation is trying to say. I mean, self-selection and segregation are not the same thing. And having space that's communal or, you know, kinship, that's not what segregation is. And so I think I'm very clear in laying out what that means, where I'm also, you know, perhaps as contradiction, like I went to a historically Black college. I'm a member of Black organizations. So I think intra-racial space, intra-ethnic, you know, there are all kinds of spaces for people to be seen and to be affirmed that are not about segregation. Bronzeville was also known as the Black Belt. So this is the swath of the South Side that Black migrants from the South moved to. So you did have vibrancy that was there. You had clubs, you had musicians who came. You also had horrible housing that was there. And you did have, you know, blues and jazz and restaurants and class diversity, because it didn't matter how much money you had. If you were Black, you had to live there. Bronzeville was not known as Bronzeville, I would say, after the Supreme Court ruled that restrictive covenants were unenforceable. You had public housing that was built there. It was then called the low end. And then in the 1990s, you had professional African-Americans coming back to the neighborhood and taking the gray stones and rehabbing them and rechristening the neighborhood Bronzeville. You know, some argue that, you know, Chicago is truly the capital of Black America, especially with politics and business. So I think a lot of people have heard of Bronzeville, not everybody in this country, but we're talking about historic Black neighborhoods and spaces. You know, I would say, yes, Harlem has more name recognition, but I think Bronzeville would be second. I mean, what I would say broadly is that Chicago's strength and its weakness is its vastness. So it's very easy for you not to leave your neighborhood or surrounding neighborhoods because you get what you need. And so there's an intentionality that's there to travel to other parts of the city, you know, that aren't tourists or that, you know, that's not the downtown or, you know, the hot night spots. The thing about integration or desegregation is that it's about removing barriers for people to live places. And so people have the right to live where they want to live. And there are a lot of personal decisions and dynamics that go into that. But there are a lot of barriers, you know, whether it's how much your voucher will get you if you're on Section 8, or about generational wealth, who gets down payments for homes, where do banks lend, you know, where is predatory lending happening? So there are a slew of barriers, structural barriers, institutional barriers that are in existence, and they don't have to use race as a term, because race neutral typically, you know, benefits white people. You know, I'm talking about barriers being removed, but also how can we use arts and culture to help promote other parts of the city? And so there's a, you know, an understanding that is maybe a shared understanding that emerges. And, you know, art is a way to bring these policy issues to the masses.
This is part one of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided.
My name is Tonika Lewis Johnson, and I am a social justice artist. My primary medium used to be photography, but it evolved into something else that includes placemaking, helping people understand the geography around them. So a lot of my work uses the Chicago landscape as a medium, as a whole way to engage individuals about large systemic issues. So I'm still trying to figure